satin balloons till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland. The Rule Book and Calendar of Kidri Embers, Chapter 4, Meadowlark. Kidri woke in a trembling darkness. Deep beneath her belly, she could feel the pillowed beating of metal parts, and in her waking dream she imagined herself within the oily workings of an enormous clock. Velvet floor pressed against her cheek, so richly soft she mistook the rug for a blanket and reached for the edges that she might roll inside the pleasant bedding. But there were no edges. Instead, her fingers bumped over a familiar bundle. She dragged the leather-strapped books to her chest, and her eyes checked open to make sure the books were real. She saw only blackness. "Dossie," she whispered, but she knew he wasn't there. He would be at her neck, or ear, or in the pocket of her dress. She couldn't remember much. A creeping cold, a terrible rainstorm, and the bad dream ended in a furious light, with two men splashing through a river. Kidri undid the leather cord and slid the books apart. She opened the heavier rule book and set her nose in the trough of its handmade pages, inhaling the sweet scent of pressed leaves. The smell of the book was the smell of her life, and it comforted her. She had no photographs of her parents, no tokens or mementos from their life in the swamp. But the rule book was enough. She could turn to any page from the past and discover a full-color memory. What she thought, imagined, considered, accomplished, all could be brought back to life. Rule number 81, for example, would forever link her to her last happy night in the swamp, to the sound of her father singing, to Quinella struggling over the ridge, and to the disaster that followed. So long as she had the rule book, her life was safely with her. She pressed her eyes into the paper and felt the tears softening the pages. "Not now, Kidri," she warned herself. She turned roughly over on her back to change the subject of her soul. Her cheek brightened with tingles as the tears dried. At first, she thought it was the diamond afterglow of those tears, but after blinking hard, she could still see it. High above, in the far distance, like a shaft of brown in an expanse of black, a thin scratch of light. As she stood, her eyes held the ghostly glimmer. The room shook under her feet, pitched side to side, as though trying to throw her back to the floor. Cautious steps inched her forward. She battered her right arm through the air until the knuckles brazed over a skin-feeling surface. She pushed at the object and then, feeling the springy seat, suddenly knew what it was. A leather-covered bench. The brown scratch brightened and yellowed as she got closer. Careless dots of dust floated by the close face of the light. One of the long-ago puzzles from the rule book had asked her to solve the mystery of dust. What is it? What is dust? Think, imagine, try, you must. The question bored her at first. Wasn't dust just dust? Her parents wore limp smiles that weren't meant to be seen. They'd all gone outside to stomp dust clouds from the dry mud. Kittery remembered she'd called out over and over, "It's just dust! It's just dust! It's just dust, dust, dust!" until she'd fallen down laughing in the brown fog of just dust. Later, lying on her mattress right before sleep, she'd heard her mother say, in the extra light voice she used when she was secretly wanting to be overheard, "I wonder, my dear, if smoke is dust." Her father saying, "That's a good question," in the big empty way that meant he wasn't even thinking about it, but hoped the eavesdropper would. Kittery sat against her elbow and stared at the orange light of the family fire. Hot cuttings and light embers went blowing up into the chimney ketch. After a moment, she'd realized these bits and pieces, this dust rising from the fire. Was the wood itself transformed by flame? The dust of the fire was the dissolving of trees, of bark and branches. And then the following morning, as the sun stepped boldly through the window, she'd watched the motes and miniature dots and applied this new sensibility. And she knew, suddenly, that dust wasn't just dust, that there was no such thing as dust. A tiny revelation, because dust was the brittle, rotted, and fallen-off bits of the world itself, was the lost bits of chairs, tables, the books on the shelves themselves, the curtains, the beds, the blankets, their bodies even. Everything was falling to pieces in the simmering air. But there was nothing that wasn't something else first, nothing that started out life as dust. Now, in the dark, shaking room, as she approached the scratch of light, Kittery wondered about these small fragments of dust. What else was in this room with her, beside the leather bench? At the wall, she stood on tiptoes, but fell a foot or so short of the light. She'd need something to stand on if she wanted to look out. It was obviously a painted-over window. A careless painter's finger must have dragged through the wet paint, leaving a thinned clearing. She opened her rulebook and pressed it into the weak glow. Enough to read by, anyway. She turned the pages until she found the entry for the day before yesterday, the day of the storm. In the calendar box was an inky drawing of black clouds and stone-like rain channeling into waves, into flood. There was no rule for that day, but a reflection. The calm after the storm, the stillness following great disaster, is the earth's advice you'll one day master. Inadvertently, and without question, Kittery had followed the suggestion. Such alignments were increasingly familiar. Kittery turned to the next page. Like her memory of it, the page was nearly empty. No weather forecast, nothing about the stars, no predictions or games. Just a terrifying, childlike drawing of two men in long jackets leaning from a half-sunk car. Below the picture, in the familiar, antique handwriting, was rule number 82. She shivered as she read it. Obviously it was beyond her control. It wouldn't have been her choice. She wouldn't have gone with them, not willingly. Regardless, she felt the trespass, the grim violation of it. Rule number 82 was the first rule she'd ever broken. As though to perfectly establish her understanding of the breach, and in a way to challenge the fairness of its premise, she read it out loud. Rule number 82. Of all the invitations to terrible dangers, this rule is firm. Never travel with strangers. Thank you. flowers, butterflies, so fragile for the wind, the sky, and the way we go. Are your suitcase packed? All the birds take flight. Good night, moon. Good night, night. And the way we go. You're a butterfly. Bloodshot eye with a rainbow needle, you soul the sky, a shooting Neverland. If you wanna fly free like a cut loose kite, trip along lonely, you trip the light. Kittery's knees softened like water. Her empty stomach glowed a bruise in her belly. She stared at the cold drawing of the two tall men. "Shake your arms. Cold," she said out loud in a quiver. Her voice sounded awful, like the voice of someone very old, sick, in bed. She turned into the glass-black space. Her face brushed yellow in the fragment of light. Her knees buckled again, and the room shook, playing with her terror, dancing and jostling about. "Hard to breathe," she continued. She searched through her body, around the gloom of pangs. Rule number 13 had been one of the hardest rules to follow. Every time you're hit with fearing, keep track and catalogue what you're feeling. The rule still made her angry. It wasn't fair. Wasn't right or possible. How were you supposed to look at your fear in the middle of being frightened? Who did that? Fear was like a bullet. It shot through you hard and suddenly died when it struck its own end. To really feel it was an injustice. But rule number 13 urged such exploration. Her breathing went backwards and blocked itself. Breathing in felt like breathing out. She dropped down beside her books, and then pressed her face to the velvet floor. Fear made you want to go low, down, into secret caves, below covers. Her small belly enlarged in a fluff, and then went numb, pins and needles dancing down her backside. The room tossed up, and she rolled with it, clutching her books to her chest. "Very small, cold, and burning," she said. As she said it, the smallness and the coldness and the burning withdrew. Just a little, but enough. "Bees and butterflies," she said, and the flutter of wings in her chest and the buzzing of bees in her belly flew off. She examined this shift with suspicion. The truth was that she was still very scared, but where a moment before there was drowning, now she was treading water. Rule number 13 had done this. The idea came from nowhere. She went to her knees, and her fingers flew as she began to bind the books together with the cord. She cinched the strap in a cross-knit of a gift ribbon, drawing it secure in both directions with a double knot. And then she leaned the firm block of the books against the wall. Looking out, the light scratch was a priority. Her hand soon found a line of cold hooks above her on the wall. She gripped these tightly and stepped up onto her leaning stair of books. The light dazzled like a sudden fire, and she squinted it away, and then the shadows fell into flying trees, rock walls, and brown fields. Kittery stared at a blur of meadows, a repeating film strip of dark greens and blacks under a milky banner of sky. Her eyes dashed and stilled, trying to register the containing glide of land, the watercolor flood of scenes. Single trees and gray fields, cows huddled about yellow hills of hay, and then empty tracts of tall pale weed. At the bottom of her view was an undulating dark wire, the rising falling tempest. It was a timber fence separating the train track from the pastures. A train. The truth sparkled through her, undoing one of the mysteries. She said the word out loud for acceptance. Train. Kittery had never been on a train, never seen one except in books, never heard one except their parents' imitation of its percussive roll and whistle. Was she slow to figure this out? She wondered. But others have simply known from the racket and jostle, the knocking together of swollen soft metal, the unspooling, ever-lost movie of trees and cows. It was a train. It was a train with windows painted black. She listened and watched to deepen her sense of it, to associate these elements with the idea of trains. Its clutter of sounds, its struggling cabin, the gently blurred view. And then she looked down at her impromptu stepladder, the rule book beneath her toes. She'd already broken rule number 82. If there was ever a time to violate rule number 3, the rule that kept her from peeking ahead at the calendar of coming days, at the future, it was now. This was an emergency, after all. You couldn't easily or very long survive if you didn't go directly to the basic tools. But before she could stand down from her invented step of rope and pages, a pumpkin glow pulsed overhead. She stared upwards at a tangled chain of holiday lights running from one side of the cabin to the next. As the orange light came on full, Kittery heard the black click and metal slap of a latch opening. A door at the far end of the train rolled wide, and a white rectangle of light briefly showed before a dreamlike figure entered. Slow and troubled, a tall man in a long jacket limped down the velvet aisle toward her. One jagged step after the next, the man paused to tug the sails of his heavy jacket forward. His arms slept at his sides, his head brokenly set over his left shoulder, the face held down by a drooping hat. The second man appeared at the door, struggling on his knees. As though half asleep, a lifeless arm pushed a tray barely into the cabin, and then the man fell back, tumbling from view behind the door. The first man loomed over her, gasping for breath. His two hands reached a last time for the hanging ends of his jacket. His breath was sharp and hauled upon, as though his crooked throat were full of blades. One wet, grizzled cheek was visible beneath the hat. The sleepy arms rose together in a careless, mechanical motion, and his hands clamped over her waist. She gasped as the long fingers tightened. He lifted her, rotated, and set her down on the floor like a dropped pile of clothes. Choking with the effort, the man strained to the floor. His fingers scratched at the leather strap as he took the satchel of her books into his hands. And then he turned and staggered miserably down the aisle. Kidri watched him heave back toward the door. There was a small click, and the tiny orange bulbs died in halos of brown and black. Before shutting the door, his voice, like rocks, rolled in smoke, and pausing to gasp between each word, the man with her book said, "Be good, little girl."
There's no snow on the ground, just the traveling sound of this train on the tracks, sound and no turning back. Who made the moonlight so long?
It hadn't lasted long, but those few minutes of light had been enough to learn the general features of the cabin. Along both walls was a row of sturdy black leather benches, each with a narrow grey-stained table jutting from the wall. The floor was red velvet with a buried decoration of small diamonds. In the corner, near the door the man had come through, was a child's aluminum cot. Beside this was the curious tray the second man had pushed into the room. She felt for the nearest bench and then worked quickly along the seat backs to the far side. The door latch was cold, obviously locked. She dropped to her knees and crept forward, reaching upwards, until her hands bumped the aluminum tubing of the cot. The tray, she knew, would be about a foot to her right, and her fingertips went almost directly to the edge of it. Her heart soared as she felt the cool, rounded edges of a plate stacked with hard bread. She sat her legs around the edges of the tray and continued to search until she found it, the moist heft of a glass. The water burned her tongue and the dry, metal parch of her throat. She struggled the glass from her lips to keep from swallowing the water entirely down. The bread chewed like meat, tough, and marbled with salted butter. The meal lasted a moment, and sleep seemed the next likely comfort. Her attention shifted to the cot. There was no bedding, just a molded hard square of foam, but clarity itself had put her in a brighter mood. To know better what was happening was a form of strength. She was on a train. Her captors had given her food and water. There had been butter on the bread, and that was promising, an unneeded accessory, perhaps a kindness. There was also the curious reassurance of how troubled the men were. She could have bowled them down, like turtles rolling around on their backs. If only she'd known, she could have run right out the door. And she wondered, did the rule book offer such a suggestion? She winced at its loss. The train rattled loudly against the tracks, a new kind of whining groan as it forced itself up a steep incline. Kittery went to the nearest bench and went to work at once at the painted window above the table. As her nails scraped along, soft curls of acrylic sprung away. A grey blemish of light soon appeared. Both hands furiously itched at the lacquer until she'd cleared a small spot. She pressed her eyes to the window. The repeating vision of meadows had been replaced. The train had entered a forest of fire-black trees, and they were huffing over a mountain. She guessed from the light that it was late afternoon. Wrinkles of rough blue sky shone here and there, and a snow-white fog scarved about the high trunks. She could not see flame nor smell smoke, but it occurred to Kittery that the forest was on fire. As the train continued to rise, the spiky coal-black trees closed in, and the fog connected into a bank, thick and grey. In the ever-tightening army of trees, the sky was soon squeezed from view. Not only were the trees now shoulder to shoulder, but they were getting closer and closer to the train itself. Everything was narrowing and funneling down, getting darker and tighter, as though the world was shooting down in diminishment, getting smaller. She sat back onto the bench when the light completely failed. When she last looked, the wall of trees had been an inch outside the window, and she could hear the hot breath of the train as it struggled in the enclosure. The still and silent mood of the swamp crept back. Her body went quiet, and she sat without moving, without thinking, grateful for the discovery of such a peaceful way. After an enduring session of cavern blackness, the train suddenly broke free. A fireworks of brightness shone through the scratched window. The forest had ended. There was a splashing exhalation from the engine, the sound of finishing, and they rode smoothly and easily down flat track. This, however, ended abruptly when the wheels locked in a spiraling scream. Kittery's eyes went to the window at once. She stopped breathing as though to devote all possible energies to the needs of vision. Beyond a large green meadow, studded here and there with floating shapeless onyx statues, was a grotto of smashed trees. A white pebble path led through both, connecting the train through the meadow and grotto to the bleakest-looking structure Kittery had ever seen. She might have called it a castle, but there was nothing about it that looked constructed, more like a mountain burned to its core, or something left behind after some geological tumult. A topple of rough peaks gave way to thoughtless valleys. After a moment she noted the shadowy lines, and saw that the edifice was like an enormous pile of the black trees from the forest. Walls of tight timber rose in the air, and at their summit gave off the silver sheen of coal. Both the lower parapets and reaching spires were ringed in the snow-white clouds she'd seen in the woods. She would not have thought it a building at all, not a castle at all, but for the fact of a long rising step that presented as a kind of lazy system of stairs building to a rising plateau, which then laid flat around the castle's base. Seated on a small throne on this plateau at the summit of these stairs was an old man, white-haired and tiny, beneath a pile of robes. Kittery longed to stare at this distant king, but her eyes were caught. Here and there across the castle walls, she saw tapering yellow sparkles and red crooked angles. It took a moment to accept the fact that the castle was smouldering, was itself on fire. The cabin door shot open. The man with the books leaned haggardly in, his awful head like a loose cannonball rolling across his shoulder. "Welcome to Meadowlark," he said. There was something private and merry and bright in his voice, a tone that suggested great relief for himself, which relief also made it perfectly clear that he supposed she would never, ever, ever get away from Meadowlark. I walk down the path through the woods before falling snow. My neighbor, black as ice, a silver dream, as we go skating down.